Good evening, all. Thank you for coming out tonight, especially if you're a Watford or Wolves supporter, because I've no idea how that finished. So tonight we're looking at another one in our series, Planted in Truth. And we're talking about planted in truth, whatever. Okay. But before we get properly started, I do just want to show you an image that Andy Cockrell sent round to me. He sent it to lots of people on Facebook during the week, and I just thought it was such a lovely image in terms of our Planted in Truth series. If you could show the next slide. And it has that tree with the roots, but it has the roots as Christ. And I sort of debated about this, you know, should the soil be Christ? And then I thought, no, we're grafted onto the vine. So actually, this is a lovely representation. And I thought this was a great picture. I'm sure you're all missing Chris, and Chris would have told you about the latest comedy show that's on Dave. He told you all about Taskmaster, and he was very much into that, and I know he did something with the young people. But there's one called Hypothetical, where they ask a group of comedians to sort of say how they would deal with hypothetical situations. There was a brilliant one the other week where one of the comedians ended up having to come into the room and leave a room saying a well-known advertising phrase for a chocolate bar that's white. And he had to come into the room and say, the Milky Bars are on me. And every time he left the room, he had to say, the Milky Bars are on me. But he pointed out, he said, you haven't told me whether I can change the intonation on that. And so he did this thing and he went out and he came and he went, the Milky Bars are on me! Yeah! And the reason I say that is actually the way we say things and definitions can matter. Whatever. Whatever's one of those words that actually I think has sort of got a bit demeaned, perhaps, in what it means. You know, it's become something to say, oh, whatever. You know, do you want a cup of tea or coffee? Whatever. You know, perhaps we've lost a bit of its understanding. But what it really means is it's not important what it is. It makes no difference what it is. And we'll come back to that in a moment. So this is where we're going tonight. I'm going to give you a little bit of context about the passage. I'm going to talk a little bit about fig trees, a bit about turning tables, a bit about moving mountains, and then some time spent looking at our response. So what's the context? The context is actually very much in our Towards Jerusalem series. This takes place just after the triumphal entry, sort of in what you might call the end game of the Easter story, just coming into that point. And this must have been an enormously difficult time, particularly for Jesus, where his time for teaching the disciples would have been short. I guess you must have had important or difficult things to do, preparing a sermon perhaps. Where you're maybe a bit stressful, you've got a concentrated period of time, you may be conflicted by all sorts of thoughts. The disciples, on the other hand, they'd been quite obedient. They'd gone and got the colt and had followed Jesus' instructions for that. They'd seen the triumphal entry. They may have been feeling a bit different to Jesus, actually. They may have been quite confident, actually. They'd spent 3 years with Jesus, and they'd seen many miracles. In fact, I went and looked up on a website to try and work out what all the miracles were, and I think I worked out that they would have seen roughly 28 miracles that we have recorded in the Bible, and there were probably many, many others. So that's the sort of context of the passage here of Jesus coming towards the cross and the disciples actually probably feeling almost like there was perhaps something a bit more victorious and a bit more confident. So I'm going to move on and talk about the three pictures there are in this passage. The first one, why curse the fig tree? Let me move on one. I don't know how good you are at looking after plants. I've lost count of the number of plants that we've killed off. But mostly it happens quite slowly at home. And I quite like the irony of being able to pick up in this sermon series about planted in truth, dealing with a plant. It's possible, if you move on the next slide, that actually this fig tree could have been symbolising Israel. You actually find in Song of Songs, if you look in chapter 2, verse 13, it talks about the fig tree bringing forth its figs. So there is something a little bit symbolic about the fig tree. But it does seem a bit harsh, doesn't it, just condemning a plant. And I did look into this a bit more, and a guy called Noel Goetz said that apparently there is something called the Braber crop on a fig tree, and that grows on the mature branches of the fig tree from the previous year's wood, which isn't like the main crop of the fig tree, which grows on the new green wood. It's not a big crop, but actually it often produces the largest and sweetest figs at a time when there are no other trees and bushes producing fruit. And so Jesus had seen this tree, which was promising fruit, promising blessing, sustenance and life. And you know, this was at a time when fresh fruit was at a premium. So he was really hoping and expecting to find that the tree would give him fruit. But if this was a picture of something else, it might also be a picture of what was happening with the temple. Because at that time, there would have been people arriving for the Passover. And in the temple, they would have expected to have found food. And as we'll see in a moment, this story bookends that turning of the tables. So it may be that this picture is talking a little bit about the failure that was happening with the Jewish people. So, at the after coming away from the temple, Jesus curses the tree and says, "May no one ever eat from you this fruit from you again." And actually, it was within a generation that the Jews rebelled. When the Jews rebelled against Rome, that the temple was actually destroyed. The priests were expelled and killed, and the temple was set on fire to get the gold that adorned the temple. I love this picture because it's a bit of a warning to us as a church to carry on bearing fruit. One of the things I do when I'm going around and is I do like to go in old churches because I think they're really fascinating buildings. But actually, you go in some old churches and they're dead. That's all they are, is a shell, a building. But you go in other churches, and there's a couple I can think of. Went to Shoreham last year and went in a lovely church there. And I went in the church at Chesterfield, which has the crooked spire. And both of them were alive. There was fruit. You could see evidence of talk about mission, of the things that they did, of serving the community, of being that active, live church. So from the tree, what about turning the tables? So if we move on to turning the tables, one of the things I hadn't noticed about this passage, and I deliberately didn't get it read out, is verse 11. Because Jesus went to the temple the day before and did a recce, and actually had a look to see what was going on, and then went away from the temple. So he didn't act rashly. There's a lot of sort of thinking that this is about acting in anger. There is an anger there, but it's a controlled anger, a righteous anger. And when Jesus is turning the tables, he quotes from Isaiah 56, where saying, "My house should be called a house of prayer for all the nations." And the context of Isaiah actually goes back to something I preached on when I was standing up here last time, which is actually about the acceptance of people within to the community of God. Because it talks about the acceptance of the eunuchs, which is what I was talking about last time, and of the foreigners. But when Jesus approaches the temple, what he finds is just buying and selling. Where the temple was designed for foreigners to congregate, it was just overrun by opportunists trying to turn a profit. And the Jewish leaders had let this happen. And this raises a question of where do we see that sort of exploitation? Not necessarily in our churches, but it may be. But in particular, where we see the foreign exploited or the outcast shunned. One of the things that was in the news, I think it might have actually been today, but certainly this week, is I hadn't realised that the Church of England had released an app last year which allowed you to report if people working in car washes may be subject to modern slavery. What a fantastic thing. And I am going to be controversial now, because apparently the Pope last year said at a conference back in September on xenophobia, racism and populist nationalism in the context of global migration, said no one can remain indifferent to the way minority groups are increasingly the object of so much fear, scorn and hatred. And he warned that those who profit from exploiting foreigners or people in precarious situations, and those who contribute to today's new forms of slavery, that one day they will have to answer to God for the choices they have made. How accepting are we as individuals and as a church? How much have we lost our original purpose and are about maintaining what we are? But it is important to remember that while there is this righteous anger, we mustn't sin in our anger, but we are called to take action, and that action must have timing. Just as an aside, I did pick up one of the Christianity magazines this morning, and sadly I think they've all gone, but if anybody has one or wants to borrow the one that I have a look. There's a lovely thing in there about how to pray. And if you want to see somebody praying angry, this guy... wife had a tumour, and he had a friend with him, and the friend prayed this sort of classic prayer that, well, if it be your will that this man's wife be taken, please give so and so the strength to do this. And this guy just lost it with God and got angry with God and prayed in his anger. But that was right, because it was a righteous anger. And he subsequently came to understand that what he was showing was his love for his wife, which God had as well. So go away and read that story. So from the trees to the mountain. So it was the disciple Peter, actually, that observed about the withered tree. And Jesus' response is to saying, well, that's nothing. And then he goes on and gives that wonderful thing about talking about the mountain and saying, if you say to the mountain, go throw itself into the sea, and you believe it, it will happen. Isn't that just like that verse that Paul has in Ephesians? Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power. There's a lot of discussion about what the mountain could mean, because Jesus does say this mountain, and it could actually mean the Mount of Olives. And actually in Zechariah it does say, his feet will stand in that day on the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, making a very great valley. Half the mountain will move towards the north and half towards the south. So maybe this is a part of understanding that prophecy. But what an amazing thing to talk about, that a mountain can be moved. So let's go back and reframe the verse that we had. Therefore, I tell you whatever... And it's not... back one, please. It's not important what it is. It makes no difference what it is you ask for in prayer. Believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. Isn't that amazing? Well, there are a few things just in response that we need to think about. Firstly, believing. Do you believe? if you're not yet a believer here, you just need to take that step of faith which says, I believe, even if it's followed by help my unbelief. But actually, that help, that unbelief is for all of us. We all have doubts, whether it's questions as to why God allows suffering in the world, to our own personal circumstances and the things that happen in our life. And I can look around the church here and see people who I know have been through that and have probably questioned God in that position. And there is another warning in here really as well, because if you believe, you should be bearing good fruit. But if you're rebellious and refuse to bear fruit, well, you're not really going to ever be praying with that belief. And then the next thing is forgiveness. And that very next verse after that amazing promise is, and when you stand praying, if you hold anything against anyone, forgive them, so that your Father in heaven may forgive your sins. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. It's a powerful message. Those of you that know Eric, who's one of the street pastors, is very hot on this and very hot on saying that actually the root of all anger is often because people aren't able or haven't got to that position of forgiveness, of being able to say, I accept and I'm sorry, you know, I forgive you for that hurt. But then next we need to think about our motives. Do we want things for our own church's success? Who do we actually exploit? Where are your motives when you pray? Now, I was praying fervently as I was working on this that Eastleigh might hold on to their 2-0 lead when I was listening yesterday. It didn't happen. But my motives in doing that, it's not important. It's not something that really is for God to be handling. And of course, we won't be doing some of those things like coming here and selling sacrificial animals rather than serving. But we do need to watch how we are. Have we ever borrowed money from a generous friend with no intention of repaying it? When we're at work, do we push our less savoury tasks onto your subordinate simply because you've got the power to do it? Do you ask favours of people who you know don't know how to say no? And we need to also be prepared to speak up when we see others doing those things. And we have spoken a bit about anger, and I think anger is one of those difficult emotions, but it's not necessarily a negative emotion, because if it's directed properly, it will be that seed that may help actually take action that God can use. So there are lots of conditions on this promise in this passage. We've got to have faith in God, and without that faith, we can't be expected to receive anything. But that faith alone isn't sufficient. We need to ask in faith. We need to pray boldly. We need to keep God's commands, to bear the right kind of Christian fruit in our lives, to pray in Christ's name and to pray always. And it's about God's will. So this verse isn't a blank check. It's really about us praying from a position of God's will. Now, trying to find God's will is a tricky thing to do sometimes, or it can feel like it. As a church, we're going through a vision process to try and find that long-term vision. But it's not that difficult if we just stick to those principles that God has shown are his will for us. And this is where this is a sort of whatever thing, because really, it's about us living godly lives to inherit his kingdom. And making sure that we don't ask for things which are just to spend on our pleasures. Go and have a look at James 4, verse 3, if you want to see the warning there. So we can be praying fervently, but for the wrong things. But I want to move on to the final thing, which is perhaps the hardest bit of all. And that's, we're waiting for God's indication, but we need to pray with persistence. It can often seem that God's answer is no, but sometimes we need to continue praying until we are clear that that answer is no. And sometimes we can even pray to try and change God's mind. I come back to that story from Christianity Today, and there was a sense in which there was a real, almost a plea, you know, I want God's mind to be that this person is healed. But there's a lot of examples of people praying things in the Bible and them not actually getting hold of them. For example, Christ prayed 3 times in the Garden of Gethsemane that the cup might be taken from him. Paul prayed about his thorn in the flesh and wanted that to be taken away. But God made his will clear. And obviously, I played Zechariah a couple of times. I seem to be typecast as that. I'm obviously an old man. But he was praying for a child that he just didn't think would ever come. And that was eventually met with John. Remember, godly faith is the evidence of things not yet seen. And we are to walk by faith, not by sight. Until we know that God's answer is no, we're called upon to keep praying to sense God's will. But once it's been clear, then we need to move from that. So I want to close by saying, start seeing. There's one other place that mountain moving is mentioned, and that's in Matthew 17, verse 20. And so Jesus said to them, because of your unbelief, for assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. The difficulty is we start to try and solve our own problems. And actually, all that God asks is we have that faith of the mustard seed. And it's great that we're coming to the communion table tonight to share communion. And actually, it's great that we have those tiny little bits of bread. Because actually, that tiny little bit of bread and that tiny little bit of grape juice is just that amount of faith that we need to actually move those mountains and to actually claim that promise that whatever, whether it's something physical, and I say Jesus dealt with a tree, whether it's something that seems just too big to possibly happen, moving a mountain, or whether it's the difficulties that you face in your own life that you are praying fervently to God for, that small bit of faith is all that you need. We're going to sing one song before we move into communion, and that